quite frequently, and it's not just UFOs.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight my guest is Ted Phillips. Ted Phillips began investigating UFO reports in 1964 and was a research associate of Dr. J. Allen Hynek from 1968 until Dr. Hynek's death in 1986. It was at Allen Hynek's suggestion that he began specializing in physical traces associated with UFO sightings in 1968. Ted has personally investigated hundreds of UFO cases. He was a member of a select team invited to meet with the United Nations Secretary General at the UN in New York, along with Hynek, Jacques Vallée, and Gordon Cooper. He gave two presentations at the first International UFO Congress and a presentation at the first MUFON Symposium. Most recently, he was part of the History Channel documentary, UFO Hunters and Alien Encounters. Good evening, Mr. Phillips.
Hi.
And how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. It's great to be on your show.
Well, I thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, you're certainly welcome.
If I remember correctly, you worked on one of the most famous trace cases ever. And that was the Socorro, New Mexico in the 60s with Lonnie Zamora?
Yes. Actually, from the time I was, 9 years old, I would listen to Frank Edwards give UFO sightings, flying saucer sightings back then, on the radio. And I was really fascinated with the subject, and I got into astronomy, meteorology, and all different things. Always had a great interest in science. And when the Socorro event took place in 64, I thought, well, this sounds exceptionally good. And of course, Allen Hynek also was one of the primary investigators, and I was just there as an independent investigator, and was fortunate enough to over the years talk to Lonnie Zamora, the witness, on a couple of occasions. A great guy, totally credible. And because the case involved physical evidence, the landing imprints, the burned bushes, and so on, I really got hooked. And so I started looking just independently into landing cases here in Missouri. And in 1968, I got hold of a witness, three witnesses, who saw a daylight object 10 o'clock in the morning, and they're highly credible people. And they took two photographs of the object 300 feet away in daylight, and showing a lot of structure on the object. And they had $600 of camping gear burned by this thing. And I thought at that point, well, this is too good to just put in the files. So I took a long shot, and I called Allen at Northwestern University, and somehow got through, and we talked, and he flew down, and we got with the witnesses, looked at the negatives, and he took them back to Northwestern. And from that point on, he asked me to work with his little group in 1968. And it was just then I was really, I suppose, in the big time. You don't get any better than Hynek and Vallée and those folks.
Oh, a historic group. And, you know, oddly enough, that it was listening to Frank Edwards' radio program that got you started at the age of 9.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Frank Edwards' book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business, that got me going at age 10.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, well, Edwards did a great service, you know, as far as getting the stuff out. And he was working to a great degree with Donald Keel, who did, I believe, the first book on flying saucers. Flying Saucers Are Real, I think, was the name of it. And that was way back there. And but Edwards dealt with generally military cases. And so I would sit there, you know, 9 o'clock at night, fascinated by the fact that military people were seeing and reporting these things. And so Socorro really pulled me into it, because it is truly an exceptional case.
Well, and a lot of the reports you read only talk about marks on the ground that were made by the landing gear.
Mm-hmm.
And then here, just a few years ago, I learned that there were also footprints.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there were some small, what appeared to be footprints. They weren't really, they were hard to distinguish, but they weren't animal tracks. There were also a couple of marks where the object had been resting that to the side, that looked like perhaps a sort of ladder was let down, and the two edges at the base of the ladder went into the soil. And so there were those, and then what appeared to be small human-like footprints, and the four landing indentations, and the bushes that have been subjected to several thousand degrees of heat. Just a tremendously significant report, and especially Zamora was such a credible guy. And there were additional witnesses. A family of five saw the thing coming in, and it almost took the top off their automobile as it went over. And then they saw Zamora coming down the highway from the opposite direction, pulling off on the little dirt road and heading out where it had landed. So it was a well-substantiated case.
Yeah, and then NASA coming up and saying that it was in actuality a test of a lunar lander being picked up by a helicopter.
Uh-huh.
With two NASA guys on the ground. Now, you'd think that if that's what the case was, that Zamora would have seen a helicopter.
Well, no question. He was 185 feet from the object at the close point. And again, this was in good, bright daylight and clear conditions. I mean, if he can see two little 3-foot-tall guys, he probably could have seen and heard a helicopter. And I did a good deal of research on the lunar lander testing, and actually the first test didn't take place until, I believe it was September. And of course, the Zamora sighting was in April, and the test was not in that area at all. The things were actually tested in California, and they had about 10 minutes flying time as far as fuel. And they were very difficult to handle because they were replicating a device that was going to the moon with 1/6 the gravity and no air. And so it was virtually impossible to stabilize one of the things. And I doubt seriously if they would have had one, even if they'd been testing them that early, flying over the city of Socorro. And not only that, if you know, they were built in a way that they left the base of the limb on the moon, and just the pilot compartment would take off physically and rejoin with the orbiting rocket. And so what happened to that that whole lower section? And not only that, if you look at the configuration and distance between the landing pads on the lunar limb, they don't in any way match the four imprints at Socorro. They were rectangular and wedge-shaped, the base, and the limb pads were circular. And the ones that were actually tested just had like four round pipes that they would sit on. So you certainly wouldn't have had these nicely configured landing imprints at Socorro from something like that. And someone even came up with a super goofy idea trying to explain it away as a hot air balloon. And, you know, at some point we have to get real with this stuff. And there just seems now to be such a need to explain away or to be the guy that comes up with an answer, no matter how tough the case is. And I've always approached these things on the fence. And if it was a hoax, if analysis or investigation indicated it was a hoax, so be it. And if it was an unknown and remained that way, so be it. And I've never felt the need to produce an explanation.
Well, it just seems like this is a line that we use a lot in ICAR. They've gone from weather balloons and swamp gas to flares.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they use the flares for a lot of different sightings anymore, and it doesn't matter if it's in the United States or even outside of Arizona, like they tried to do with the Phoenix Lights thing.
Exactly. And that really is the primary reason. Well, there were a couple of good reasons, but that Alan suggested I concentrate on landing cases with physical residue, and that is, if you have multiple witnesses in daylight over a several minute period of observation at a distance of 15 to, let's say, 50 feet from a structured metallic-appearing object sitting on the ground, generating physical evidence, physical residue, and then it takes off, it would be pretty difficult to call that flares. And that's why we always try to stay away from the aerial sightings unless it would be a daylight sighting or at extremely close range. And you can explain away lights in the night sky with all kinds of possible answers. And one of the big aggravations for me is just a week or two ago, UFOs were a really hot topic on CNN, Fox, and some of the cable news networks. And every time you would see the headline come up, lights in the sky. And it's as though that's all the media knows. They have no idea that there have been thousands of sightings of structured objects, and in daylight, and in at close range, and sitting on the ground, leaving behind physical evidence. And the second thing they'll bring up is, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? And right now, I've got in the files 3,238 cases of landings from 92 countries where physical residue was found. And so I think that's a considerable amount of evidence. And, you know, we just somehow we have to get the media off of and aware of things other than lights in the sky and start talking about good cases. And so that's my goal. That's one of the things that I've tried to do for years. When the right case comes up, then I'm going to try my best to get it out on the media simply to make people aware that these kind of sightings do happen, which the History Channel, I've had a lot of feedback from that. People simply saying, you know, an email or whatever, I had no idea that these things were seen other than just little lights in the sky. And so there's a lot of educating to do for the general public, and the media is responsible in a very large part for that.
Well, I don't look forward to mainstream media, so to speak, especially television, other than like local stations, but national newscasts to do much more than the giggle factor type reporting of incidences like this.
Well,
look what happened with the O'Hare Airport case.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was one that I really had my fingers crossed would go forward, that it would be handled with a little bit of grace. And the problem is you have a lot of people wanting to get their opinion out there, and you get a scientist who has never read a flying saucer report in his life, and he sees something like this, and it's, excuse me, it's a fast, easy way to get a lot of publicity, so you come up with an explanation. And it doesn't matter how goofy it is, the media will grab onto it because Dr. So-and-so said it was so. And it is very difficult to get the really good stuff out in the media. It's very difficult. We tried that for many, many years. And occasionally we would have success. And Dr. Hynek, of course, was extremely credible and was viewed so by a lot of the moderators, Larry King, Dick Cavett, a lot of those people who had TV talk shows, and but yet there would be that giggle factor even with him, and so it's a very high benchmark to get over.
Have you heard about the recent? I haven't been able to find out an exact date and location of where this incident happened, but it was just released to the public. October 30th in Romania. It involved a Romanian Air Force MiG having a collision with a UFO.
Yes. Yeah. I have seen a little bit on that. The problem there, and I know a good bit about East European countries, you run into a lot of information problems. For example, when I was, I don't know if you've noticed on the website, if you've had a chance to look at Project Moonshaft, which is a very ancient artifact deep in a cave in Slovakia. And I've been there a number of times. And on the second trip over, a family of Slovakians I had become friends with came to where I was staying, and they said, we've just seen on national television video of a UFO that flew over a nuclear power plant here in Slovakia. And I had driven by that plant just 3 days before it happened, and so immediately I called the director of national Slovakian television and asked him for a copy of the video. And he said he would try to get permission. In the meantime, I went down to Levice, where this happened, and I found a lot of people who wouldn't say much other than, yes, I saw this object, too, fly over the plant. And I did find that it had flown over the old nuclear plant, which was shut down. The new one had been in operation for 2 weeks. And this object, which was circular, very bright, came down, flew over the main control station, almost hit one of the chimneys coming out of the control station, and stopped and hovered 20 feet above one of the active nuclear reactors, and hovered there for 10 minutes, and then went vertical and disappeared into the sky. And all of this was captured by a great number of security video units all over the nuclear station. And somehow or other, this one from one of the cameras got on national television. And when I got back to Poprad, the gentleman had called me, and he said that the government officials had been to the TV station and taken the tape, and that they were not supposed to have had it in the beginning. So it's very difficult to get information out of those East European countries because of government controls and so on. And I never, ever saw this nuclear power plant incident reported anywhere outside of Slovakia, not to this day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard of it either.
Yeah, I've got it on the website. I've got some photo ant and the details. It's quite an interesting case.
On this Romanian MiG, my husband and I was checking out the video, news video, of this. Of course, we couldn't understand it because neither one of us speak Romanian.
Right.
But we are working on getting it translated.
Mm-hmm.
There is an interview with the pilot. But my husband and I were just looking at the damage, and I noticed that there was a tail coat on the plane. So we started looking up the tail coat. So there, and we found that it was the first plane to be retrofitted with the gear that it has, you know, the upgrades that it has currently, and found that it was also being used as a air show tour plane. And so we're thinking that this incident either A, happened at an air show, or B, on the way to an air show.
Exactly, yeah. Good detective work. That's great.
That's what happens when you're interested in aircraft.
Yes. Well, it's, you know, it's really too bad that we can't get into those kind of cases. I mean, rarely. Back in the old days, we would get radar data and telemetry from missile tests where objects would approach, let's say, an Atlas missile after launch. And only because Alan and the group knew some of the radar operators or the folks that were in that immediate area at the time and so on. And but, you know, of course, in this country, it's almost impossible to get information on the military sightings. And I do know for a fact I've had a base commander, Strategic Air Command base commander, tell me, for example, of flying a B-52 in daylight and having a structured about 30-foot disc with round sort of ports or windows around the rim, flying off the wingtip of the B-52, and two of his men are back there shooting every roll of 35-millimeter film they had and got some really great pictures. And, of course, those went to Washington, and that was the end of that. So, it you know, it happens, and, I mean, there's no question.
Have you seen pictures of the damage done to the MiG?
Oh, no, I haven't, no.
The main part of the canopy that opens up, it opens up and out to the right of the pilot, to the side. The plexi is completely gone off of that. And it also clipped the right rear tailplane.
Do you have any kind of description of the object?
I don't know. I don't speak Romanian.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
But, however, I have found out today that I might have a lead on someone here in the Phoenix area that can translate the video footage and also the website, the Romanian news organization's website article about it as well. And as soon as I get that, I will let everybody know.
Oh, great. Yeah. Well, I certainly know about the translation stuff. I have a lot of the physical evidence cases, the landing cases that are still not translated. And that's another frustrating thing. And actually, in July of this year, two families traveling, vacationing in Slovakia saw independently a metallic disc and shot video of it 40 minutes apart time-wise and about 35 miles apart physically, and that ran on Slovakian news site. And I have a friend from Slovakia that's sending me clips and also the translation. And this thing, now the short clip that I saw, nice daylight conditions, and this thing was just fairly close. And
oh, my.
It was a disc with a domed upper section, and
Well, unfortunately, we need to go to a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Ted Phillips here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And tonight we're talking with Ted Phillips, who is an expert on physical trace case UFO sightings. And Ted, during the break we were talking about the, oh gosh, you told me the name of it again, and now I forgot it again.
Delphos? The
yes.
Delphos case? Uh-huh.
Yeah. That one I found very interesting. They saw the thing on the ground and saw it in the sky and called you.
Yeah, Delphos, Kansas, and it is one of the 10 best landing cases to date, as far as I'm concerned. And actually, it's kind of funny. We had the normal back in the 70s routine of getting a case, and of course, if you have physical evidence on the ground, exposed to the weather, time is of the essence. So you're always hoping you're going to get the report very quickly. While at Delphos, the Salina, Kansas newspaper sent a reporter out about 3-4 days after it happened. They ran an article. A lady in Salina cut the article out, sent it to a friend of Alan Hynek's in Ohio, and she in turn sent it to Alan, and he immediately called me. Well, it was almost 4 weeks after the event happened, and rarely do you see a whole lot remaining, you know, because they'd had rain, they'd had snow, and all this, and that's another hurdle that is a major problem, is getting the information quickly and getting at this stuff while it's fresh. And fortunately, the Salina reporter took a lot of photographs, so I was able to see it in the pretty well original condition. And very briefly, a 16-year-old boy and his family arrive home out on this remote farm, and he goes out, it's after dark, he goes out to the sheep pen where he has a project with some young sheep, and he's going to show them and all this. So he goes out to feed the sheep with his dog Snowball, and this is in a very, very dark area out. There's one yard light, and it's up by the house, and this is about 250 feet out. Pitch black, and he's got a little flashlight working on feeding the sheep, and all of a sudden he hears this noise start up that he described as like an old washing machine that was out of sync. It was making a lot of noise and kind of a rumbling, banging sort of sound. And the area beyond a hog shed to his right, the area behind that lit up, and he could see all the trees and so on. And he stepped out from behind the sheep shed, and 35, 40 feet away, he sees this object about 8 to 10 feet in diameter and about 10 feet tall, stationary, and it's the base of it is about 5 feet above the ground. And it's beneath a lot of tree limbs, which becomes very interesting. And this thing is a mass of multicolored light that's changing, extremely bright. But the most interesting thing turns out to be, from the base of it, he sees a sort of shimmering, luminous vapor coming down from all around the base of the object, falling to the ground like a mist. 1 foot above the ground, it stops, this mist, and there's nothing from a foot above the ground to the ground. And now how you stop something like that, I don't know. But as he watched, the ground beneath where this mist was falling began to develop a sort of haze or fog in a circle. And it rose, he thought, maybe 4 or 5 inches above the ground, but not up to the end of this streaming luminous stuff. And the dog was very quiet, didn't bark, didn't move. The sheep were deathly quiet, didn't move. And Ron told me, he said, I wanted to run, but I couldn't move, which, of course, could have been purely fear. And after watching this thing for really an undetermined period of time, I think in the long run, and I've always thought that there were other things happening, that perhaps he was there a good deal longer than he remembered. And but at one point, the object kind of rocked back on its vertical axis and started moving down this narrow shelter belt under the trees, and then made an abrupt right turn and went over a hog shed, cleared it, and as it cleared it, the whole thing got really bright, and the sound changed from this rumbling, banging noise to a high-pitched whistle, and he could no longer see. He was totally blind. And I asked him, I said, could you see spots, like if somebody popped a flash in your face? He said, no, everything just went black. And he could hear the sound of the object receding to the south, and in a few seconds, he started, as the sound got fainter, regaining his vision, looked to the south and saw it as a large, circular, luminous object, and moving slowly away. And he ran to the house. He got his mother and father. They ran out. They all saw the object as it moved away to the south. It was seen by Minneapolis policemen as it flew over Minneapolis, Kansas, to the south. It had been seen by a farmer to the west of the Johnson farm as it came in and landed in the farm in this tree area. And I learned a couple of months after the fact that the farmer across the road from where this happened was out on his tractor, and he saw the object come up out of the Johnson shelter belt area, and it cleared the Johnson home and came down in his field, and it was kind of bumping along, he said, like you're trying to get a car moving, as though it was having a lot of problems, and it finally bumped and bumped and then ascended and then flew on to the south. And that was at the point where Ron had gotten his mother and father, and they saw it. So after hearing his story, the mother and father and Ron go out around the hog shed, out into this dark shelter belt, which has nothing in it. It's open on the north side out into a large open field, and none of the animals are ever allowed out there because then they'd run off in the field. And as they walk towards the spot where the object had been, they see in the darkness an 8-foot glowing, brightly glowing ring of soil. And they walk over to it, and Mr. and Mrs. Johnson get down on their knees, and they're curious, and they touch the soil. As they touch the soil, their fingers, both of them, go numb. And Mrs. Johnson, immediately in fear, rubbed her fingers on her slacks, on her leg, to try to rub the stuff off, and an area, a circular area on her leg, became numb. And let's see, that was in 1971, and year before last, I talked to her in that area, that spot was still numb. So it's a pretty long-lasting effect. The effect in her fingers lasted about 2 weeks, and Mr. Johnson only about 2 or 3 days. Well, after they touched the soil, and it was pitted, it was kind of hard, and it was cool, Ron asked his mother, he said, do you have any film in the camera? And she said, I don't know. So they all ran to the house, and they have a Polaroid camera. And there was one image left, and they went out, and she set the camera up and shot the picture without a flash in that pitch darkness, and got the only photograph that I have ever seen within 5 minutes of a UFO ascent of a luminous ring. And it's a remarkable thing to see. And so at any rate, they reported it the next day. The sheriff, highway patrol, come out. And the sheriff fortunately took a great daylight photo of the ring, which is almost has an almost pure white surface. And he took samples and locked them up in the sheriff's office vault, which is light and airtight. And when I arrived almost 4 weeks later, he gave me those samples. and they, the soil had turned from the white to the normal, yet kind of light brown color. But all of this white material was gone. And this in an airtight, light, tight condition. And when we got out to the farm, I was amazed because it had snowed overnight, and the temperature was up like 42-3 degrees, and the shelter belt was a mud bog. I mean, it was just slimy, wet, and the soil very dark and wet and muddy. And here is the ring perfectly outlined with unmelted snow. And that made for some great photos. And I found by skiffing the snow off the surface of the ring that if you, it was bone dry. It was like a freshly waxed automobile surface. And where everything else is mud, in the center of the ring, around it, and so on. And if you poured water on the ring, it would just bead up or run off. This soil would no longer absorb water at all. And in taking the soil samples, I found that this effect went 14 inches deep into the ground, which is pretty incredible. The ring glowed for 4 nights following the event, and it was seen by a number of people. Yeah, yeah, great case. And also the roof and the back of that hog shed glowed, not as brightly, but there was some sort of residue falling as it flew over, and there was a light residue luminous from the ring down to the point where it turned and went over the hog shed. It's a great case.
Well, a lot of times on landing cases like that, there are quite a bit of changes to the soil to where it doesn't want to absorb water.
Right, right. And those...
That's fairly common.
Yeah, the two of the most significant things that you can find, to me, in a landing site would be luminous material and the dehydration, where... I have photographs of this soil, which, of course, wouldn't produce any plant growth. I did a number of experiments, which were then conducted at some other laboratories. And I could put, with an eyedropper, a drop of water on top of a chunk of this ring soil. And I have photographs of that water bead standing up nicely 30, 40 minutes later. And it would only finally disappear by being evaporated into the air. It's just incredible. I submerged chunks of the ring soil in water, and it would just lie there, just dry. Truly incredible stuff. So I watched for those things, and after that case, then I started really making a point of going back out into sites in the dark, to check and see if there was any luminosity, because that was something, frankly, we hadn't thought of. You know, normally if you're investigating a case, you want to do it in daylight where you can see, and we had not thought of the possibility of any luminous material. And there was a good case, a good landing in Russia, where 12 people saw an object land in daylight, and a couple of guys got out, and they walked away from the object, and I have some samples of this material and photos taken right after this happened. And where they had stepped, there were circular areas of luminous material. And you can put a black light over this stuff even now, and it will fluoresce. So some really dramatic changes take place. And what you see in so many of these sites is comparable to putting a plant in a microwave oven and zapping it. It doesn't burn. It hasn't been on fire, but it has been totally dehydrated, totally sapped of all moisture. And I've seen tree limbs. And at Delphos, there was a tree limb 8.5 feet above the ground that was broken, and what had happened was there was a electromagnetic field, a heavy field, and it heated the limb from the inside out and actually burst the limb from the inside because of the moisture that was in it. And, you know, so Where's the evidence, people like to say? I contend there's a lot of it.
Well, and then talking about the soil fluorescing and whatnot, and still and things years and years later still fluorescing with a black light. Black lights are still are used quite often to detect stuff that's not visible to the naked eye.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't go to any site without a couple of those. And night vision, a night vision scope is also very helpful. If you're out in a very dark area, you can sometimes see hot areas, luminous areas, with the night scope, because it simply increases the luminance of material. And so there are a lot of tools now that I sure wish we would have had back in those days. And we went out and we didn't actually get a lot of videotape of any of this stuff back in the early 70s. And, you know, a lot of that sort of stuff just wasn't available, at least not in the size you'd want to drag out in a isolated area. So we can do so much more now. When the really good cases come along, which are not, I have to tell you, they're not happening with the frequency today that they were back in the late 60s, 70s, and mid to early 80s. And what I see happening are the devices that leave physical residue now. We don't get as many, nearly as many reports of the 18, 20, 30-foot objects. What we're seeing now is an increase in the small light balls, and which are described as being from baseball size to beach ball size. And they typically will be very, very bright with a white light that is contained in the light ball. In other words, it doesn't light up anything around it. It doesn't project a beam or anything like that, but it's very bright and yet soft to the eye. What I'm trying to say is it's a very intense light, but it's not intense like trying to look into a headlight. It's a soft but yet intense light. It's a little difficult to describe, but and I actually have video of some of those from the Marley Woods, a site that we're currently doing research in. And I, more and more, that's what we're seeing. They follow automobiles, they come very close to people, and they're very definitely under some sort of intelligent control. Obviously, I don't think there are any little guys in a basketball-sized object flying it, but they're being controlled by something with intelligence.
Like a probe or a drone?
Yeah, or something that's gathering data, a monitor. It's really difficult to say. But the more cases we get, you know, the more information you have to try to understand at least partially what they're about. But they're totally different from the old days flying saucers. Totally different.
Well, our cars and aircraft change over the years. Why not UFOs, right?
Exactly right.
You know,
exactly. That's what you would expect, unless they're being built by some really dumb people. They're certainly going to change your technology.
And then, you know, you could get cases from all over the place. You have the recent press conference with Leslie Keene and the Coalition for Freedom of Information, and also Leslie Keene winning her case against NASA for documents referring to the Keksberg incident of the 60s as well. 65, I believe it was.
Right.
You know, and there is so much coming up that I don't know about you, but personally, I think disclosure is a lot closer than we think. Since we've got about 2 minutes till we go to the next break, what kind of wanted to get your opinion on all that?
Well, I think I was pretty negative until lately, as far as any major release of information. But you know, I think with the great abundance of video cameras and digital cameras and cell phones with cameras, eventually we're going to start seeing video that will be hard to dismiss. And the SIU, my team that is in Marley Woods and on the Moonshaft project, just 2 weeks ago videotaped an object over there. And we've got that, some of the video on our site, and we'll be adding more in the coming week. We imaged it from three different units, and it was seen by 9 people, so it's pretty well substantiated. And so I think as that sort of stuff comes out, where you have an abundance of witnesses and video, that the media is going to, I think they'll start picking up on it. And that was pretty evident here in the last couple of weeks. And they, you know, they like video. They like something visual. And so you just have to be very careful to document what you're doing so it can't be thrown into question. But I do think, yes, there's a very, very good chance that some really good information will finally get out, and there's a lot of it that that needs to come out.
I agree. And on that note, we need to go to a break. We'll be back with Ted Phillips here in a little while with On Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
I walk a lonely road, the only one that I have ever known. Don't know where it goes, but it's gone. And I walk alone. I want this empty. this empty street on the boulevard of broken dreams, where the city sleeps and I'm the only one.
Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests, and we talk about all sorts of things. Some of them are authors, some of them are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always catch our guest list at www.giascott.com.
That angels, ETs, and light beings walk beside you.
I'm ready to know.
That not only are you their creation, you may be them as well.
I'm ready.
To know that you have been trapped in your own beliefs, in your own mind, and never knowing who and what you truly are.
Let's explore these concepts and theories. You want to hear what they have to say? Join us Sunday nights, 8 Pacific, 11 Eastern. I'm Joshua James, your host of Sunday Nights and the Paranormal Radio Network. See you Sunday.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Hi everyone, Trace Sheridan for UFO Global Focus. Broadcast Sundays, p.m. Central Time on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Come join us for discussion of ufology and related topics from an international perspective.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Good evening, good afternoon, or good morning, wherever you may be. I am Sean Lonker, your host on the Midnight Highway Radio on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join me on Saturday night, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And together we can take a ride down the Midnight Highway. My topics include UFOs, ghosts, near death, and many other various subjects regarding the paranormal. My goal is to seek the truth, find the answers that we all so deeply crave. So when the witch sings on Saturday nights, guys and girls, be sure to check me out. You can also visit me at www.midnighthighwayradio.com. Don't forget, Saturday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Take care, guys.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, discussions and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to Eye of the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Network. Tonight we're talking to Ted Phillips, the director of the Center for Physical Trace Research. Ted, during the break we were talking about the Marley Woods mystery light. Would you like to go into that a bit?
Okay, yeah. Marley Woods, of course, is not the real name of the place, but it's a very remote series of three farms. And I can only say in Missouri, and sightings began there in the current group of sightings in December of 1998, and the property owner of what we call Site 1, and this, by the way, is this is all on our the SIU and the Center for Physical Trace Research site, UFOphysical.com, and the property owner of Site 1, after he and his wife had this very close sighting of a object with form, called a private investigator, had him check me out to be sure I was sane, and after he found out that I was sort of sane, he called me and asked me if I would come over and look into some of these things, because they were concerned as to what they were. And since December of 1998, I have on file 193 witnesses, and these are doctors, lawyers, bankers, ranchers, farmers, and so on, and not one of those 193 people have ever gone public about any of this. And so that's why I have to be very careful about location and so on. And they allow us to work over there. And it's basically a living research lab, in that this stuff is ongoing. And the sightings run pretty well the spectrum of UFO sightings. The small light balls, large amber objects, which are seen sometimes in rows, or different configurations of 8, 10, 15, 17 large lights, very bright. And there have been landing cases with physical evidence and structured objects observed. There have been electromagnetic cases where automobiles were interfered with, and it just about runs the spectrum, except there have been, to my knowledge, no humanoid, no occupant sightings. And but I have a feeling that there may, any of those that would have taken place are just not talked about. And, you know, because people are very afraid of being looked at as a loon to report something like a little guy. And I certainly can understand and appreciate that. But So at any rate, in March, we formed what we call the SIU, which is a Special Investigations Unit. And there are five of us, and very highly respected researchers. And I may be questionable, but the other four are highly respected. And we have a good deal of imaging equipment, and we had made our sixth trip over there, having not seen anything on the previous five. We did that 2 weeks ago, and we were fortunate enough to see one of the types of objects that are seen. And the property owner calls this thing the mystery light because it hovers generally. It remains stationary, appears in the same area each time initially, and we were able to shoot a minute and 15 seconds of video on Friday night and a minute and 4 seconds on Saturday night of this, what appears to be the same thing, with three video units, one of them a infrared CCD unit, which got some nice video. And we posted some of that on the website, and there will be more of it posted very soon.
And can you give your website address so they can look for it there?
Yeah, it is UFOphysical.com. UFOphysical.com. And you'll see the box there. You can click on Marley Woods, recent sightings on the SIU, on physical trace cases, and on Project Moonshaft, which is all another thing. But the Marley area is tremendously interesting, and I'm especially interested. We haven't been able to image ourselves yet, the small light balls, but I do have video taken by the owner of Site 2. He had seen so many of these things on the ground and coming up from the ground and following he and his wife from one window to the next from the outside, that he set up a video surveillance camera 30 feet above the ground, and he's captured several of these, and we'll be putting that video on the website. Also, some of the stills from that video is already on the website. Pretty cool stuff. And the light balls have been seen, well, a kind of typical event. Two attorneys had gone out, and they were sitting there watching for lights. And about 1,000 feet away up at a tree line, they suddenly saw a cluster of small white lights kind of frolicking around, like they were almost like they were playing with each other. And as they watched this, they were very near the ground and would go up to the tops of trees and so on. Two of the light balls broke out of the cluster and came straight at the two witnesses. The two witnesses were standing 10 feet apart, and as the two approached them, at a distance of about 150 feet, one of these small lights made a right-angle turn to the east, flew across the field, and disappeared in trees. The second one continued straight at them, and it passed between the two witnesses at shoulder height. And now remember, they were 10 feet apart, so this thing was very, very close. There was no temperature change. There was no disturbance of the air. There was no sound, nothing. And it looked exactly the same from the side, from the back, from the front. So it was a spherical, self-contained light. It didn't even cast light on the two people as it went through. And they turned, watched it go over a gravel road, out into a field, make a right-angle turn, and disappear into trees. And these things have been seen on numerous occasions. And so it's pretty obvious the research value, if we can manage to get images of these things that close, and instrument readings and so on. So this is a rare occasion where this stuff has been going on. And in talking to people in the area, we've found that these things have been seen for over 70 years. And, of course, people back way back, everyone, when they would tell someone about it, they were just deemed crazy, and that was it. So people stopped talking about it. But when you get on a one-to-one level, these people are willing to talk after you you give them your assurance that their names are not going to be used, nor the location. And then there have been sightings of structured objects. They obtained video of two dark circular objects in daylight flying to the west, one object beneath the other. The lower object suddenly, without stopping, reverses direction and goes back in the direction from which you were coming and ascends up above the second object and disappears out of camera view. And on another occasion at night, there were six people at site one, and they saw an object coming overhead that they said had to be the size of a football field, 300 feet or so, and it blocked out the stars. It was a very clear, dark night, and they could see the form. It was like a great, huge cylinder, and it was outlined by countless tiny little lights, white lights, and they obtained video that shows you can enhance it and see the form, and of course the small white lights. And the really fascinating thing about this is they watched it as it went all the way from the eastern horizon almost to the western horizon, slowly moving along, and suddenly it separated into two pieces. One continued straight on west, the other turned and went south and disappeared. And so that's the sort of stuff that's happening over there. And it's pretty remarkable. Right now, we have been in a lull for the last 6 months. Generally, you have sightings every month and several per month. The large amber objects, the really large bright jobs, there have been 241 observations of those. 65 of this mystery light that we imaged 2 weeks ago. And that has been seen, as I said, we saw it for a minute and 15 and a minute and 4 on two nights in a row. And it has been seen in videotape, becoming extremely large and bright, traveling from the north at North Point on the horizon to due east and visible for 15 minutes. So spectacular things going on down there. And as I was mentioning to you, one of our primary projects is to put a couple of IR CCD cameras on a windmill there, one where they'll cover from the north to the east, and get streaming video 24/7 to our website so people can just go on the website and watch for themselves. And I'll guarantee you, if you watch long enough, you'll see something. And so we're, as soon as we get the funding to pull that off, then that's going to be a very primary project.
That sounds like a great project. I'd love to get in on it. On the video on your website about the Marley light.
Right.
There's three lights on the ground.
Yes.
You want to explain how that was all set up for people who are checking the website?
Right, exactly. Chuck, who is the fifth member of the team, lives in Colorado, and he flew out for this trip over. And he'd been working on using three degaussing coils, large coils, to set up an electromagnetic field. As he likes to call it, he's fishing, and that's his bait. And we know that these things do emit an electromagnetic field, and so he's hoping to get their attention. And the lights are flashing in a sequence for a visual baiting of something out there. Now, that's a reach. Since we don't know what they are, where they're from, or why they're there, but it is another possibility to get their attention. And you know, if they do monitor, since they emit a field that's electromagnetic, they might be able to pick up on a new electromagnetic field, and this kicks out a pretty good field. And we didn't get any kind of reaction from it that night, but who knows? It's just something that's worth trying. And we have other types of monitoring systems, and again, are trying to get more and more so we can get as much data when this stuff pops as we possibly can. But that's what those three lights are.
Oh, and I've just been informed by our producer that we have a new record high of attendance in our virtual auditorium. So we're going to skip the bottom of the hour break and just keep right on going.
Great.
If that's okay with you.
Great, sure.
And as a new added feature here on Eye to the Sky, we have an email address where you can email your questions to either myself or my guest, which tonight is Ted Phillips, talking about trace cases. And that's questions, IEYE2thesky@yahoo.com. That's questions, IEYE2thesky@yahoo.com. I'm surprised, you know, there isn't anybody with their hands up in our virtual auditorium to ask questions. But, you know, if you guys want to, go ahead. There's plenty of time. I mean, this Marley case is very interesting. I applaud your work. I was just wondering, what is your favorite of all the cases that you work?
Oh, gosh. If I was not singling out a particular case, Marley would have to be, because it is ongoing. And our primary goal with the SIU is to not have to go in behind a UFO sighting and pick up crumbs after it's gone, but to insert ourselves into an active situation where we can get real-time data, and especially real-time imaging. And because that's, in my mind, is the way to try to better understand what's going on with these things. And as far as my primary project of all time actually doesn't deal with a UFO per se, but it's the Project Moonshaft, which is an ancient artifact in Slovakia, deep in a cavern. And but that's getting off your question. My favorite trace case, landing trace case, would probably be, it would be a close run between a landing at Cato, Missouri, and Delphos and Socorro. that's about as much as I can narrow it down. There are really a lot of good, high strangeness trace cases. And, you know, you just have to kind of, when you're trying to pick one, you have to look at all the elements involved and say, well, this has got a little more than this one. But the Cato case involved a daylight sighting for 2 hours by seven witnesses on a farm of an object 165 feet away on the ground. And that's a pretty good bit of observation. And they thought at first that it was something that had blown into the field overnight, because it was only about 4 feet in diameter, and it was kind of an oval shape. And so they watched it for a couple of hours while they casually had breakfast and so on, and they looked out the front window of the farmhouse. It was still there, wasn't going anywhere. So finally the farmer decided he would go down and get his tractor. Excuse me. anyway, he decided to go down and get his tractor and pull this thing out of the field. And as he went to the barn, he was about, 100 feet from it. And they fired up the tractor engine. And the other five people who were standing on the porch start screaming. And he steps out from around the barn. And what had happened was, when he fired up the tractor, this thing jumped straight up 10 feet above the ground and was hovering. And then it starts moving just to the right of the farmhouse. And as it does so, it's rotating once every 2 seconds or so. And a dark area comes into view, followed by the white area, by the dark area. And there's no sound, there are no wings, there are no engines. Nothing sticking out of this thing. It looks like metal, 4 feet or so long. And as it's ascending, it makes a right turn. Then it flies just a few feet, and it makes an extreme left turn and another right turn as though it's adjusting its course. And as they watch it climbing, they see high in the sky a large, cylindrical, silvery object hovering. And this little jobby flies right up and merges with the cylinder. And then they both fly away at a pretty good clip. Well, when they run down in the field, they find, guess what, a 4-foot area where the plants are dehydrated in a circular pattern. There are two little, what I like to call thruster craters, where the something has impacted the ground and has blown these little craters out, kicking the dust up. And the dust had gone into some large bull nettle plants, which are very large leaved plants. And they were not burnt, but they were drawn up as if by heat exposure. And when I opened those leaves up, they were full of the dust that was kicked out by this thrusting, whatever did it. And there was another area where the grass was swirled in a circular, tight pattern. And that, with the two little thruster craters, made a nice triangle where evidently some little footpads or something had gone down into the soil. And this was the only spot in the entire field, a big field, which had any effect like this at all. And soil samples, thermoluminescence tests, out at the Space Technology Laboratory in Kansas, indicated a slight radiation in the site, heating, no fire, but just pretty above 1,000 degrees heating. And samples I'd taken along the flight path indicated a gradual reduction in the slight radiation and heating, as you would expect as it ascended. And when I checked the weather data, I found that this thing, with no engines, no sound, actually had crossed the wind, the direction of the wind, 3 times. So it had to have been powered, and it was actually flying into the wind. So, pretty good case. And 7 witnesses in daylight and all this going on, that, I think, is an extremely high-quality case.
Well, when you have a lot of witnesses to a single event like that, that, to me, lends a lot of credibility.
Well, it makes it a lot harder for the skeptics to jump on it. And the long duration of the sighting, you know, there are a lot of factors. Heineck and I got our heads together way, way many years ago and set up some criteria for a high strangeness case. And that involves seeing conditions, number of witnesses, distance to the object, how long it was in sight. Could it have been the Goodyear blimp sitting there? No, they saw it long enough and close enough to recognize Goodyear blimp. And so you eliminate a lot of things. And by having the object sitting on the ground in front of trees and leaving recognizable site that has no explanation, and you can pinpoint where it was at, you know how far they were from it, you're eliminating the planet Venus, satellites, and all this other garbage that the government likes to toss out.
Well, the government will try and toss out any of them just to
oh, sure.
You know, keep the giggle factor up and to hide the fact that these things are real. They're here. They're visiting the planet. And they make people who see them out to be either drug addicts or alcoholics or prone to hallucinations or delusions.
Sure, sure.
Or just stupid, so stupid they don't know what they're seeing.
Sure, you need to eliminate the credibility of the witnesses and, make them look like a bunch of loonies, and then the sighting kind of goes away. But, you know, the Air Force tried very, very hard, along with a lot of other people. I'm going to be posting on the website all the information I have on some of these top cases. I mean, every sketch, every photo, every word. And Skrull will be one of them. And it's such a voluminous report, it's going to take me quite a long while. But believe me, a lot of people, including the Air Force, were trying their dead-level best to explain the Socorro landing, and it still is carried in the Air Force files as unknown. And Quintanilla, the director of Project Blue Book, in later years actually made a statement that he tried his best to explain this one and couldn't. So I'm surprised they would even admit that, but it is fact. And they certainly, most of these really super good cases that I'm talking about took place after Blue Book, and so they really couldn't comment on them because they weren't involved. At Delphos, Kansas, a couple of Air Force people did come out to the site just after it happened, and the family was kind of interested in how they even learned about it because it hadn't been out in the paper yet. And they just looked around and told Mr. Johnson, you know, I don't think I'd let anybody go out into that area. And that's all the only comment they made. So.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. I'm surprised they didn't tell him, you know, well, you can't talk about this because of national security.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't bring that up, but.
Well, we have a hand up in our virtual auditorium telling me that there's somebody who would like to ask a question. Are you ready for one?
Great.
All right. Gossamer 777, you're live and on the air with Ted Phillips.
Hi, Mr. Phillips. My name is David Andrew. I'm T's husband, media director for Eye of the Sky Show, and also the Southwest Regional Director for International Community for Alien Research. Ted, I was just curious, any of these cases where you've gotten soil samples, you'd mentioned they're not soaking up water as one of the side effects of them. Have you had any soil samples that had, like, the EMF reading might have been changed on it, or, say, soil samples that had any kind of metal in them, like iron or anything that could be magnetized, that was mysteriously magnetized or anything like that? Thank you.
And that's a great question, because the one of the rings over at Marley Woods did have a large number of very tiny magnetic particles in it. And the effects of whatever these things are, I like to term it downloading, when they're on the ground or hovering, do change the consistency of the composition of soil, and certainly a great deal of damage to plants. Again, it's very much like sticking them in a microwave oven, and yet there's rarely any burning. And on the Delphos case, we did manage to get samples to Oak Ridge Laboratories, and the director of Project Orion back at that time at Oak Ridge was a good friend of Alan Hynek's, and he was sending us some very good indicators that they were stumbling onto things. One thing was, when they opened my samples, which had been in airtight containers,
all the scientists in the laboratory went into extreme coughing spasms. And from that point on, they would wear face masks and so on, protect themselves against. They didn't know what it was, and they didn't tell us if they figured out what this what caused this coughing, what was released into the air. And but they did send us a number of electron microscopic images of the soil, and what they were imaging was a coating material on the soil. It had been coated, which sealed the soil, creating its inability to absorb anything. And they sent us very high magnification images of what they call ice crystal, tiny formations in this coating material. And they said that they had never seen anything like it before. And this was Oak Ridge. I mean, those folks are pretty well up on most everything. And they said they had never seen structures like this before. And immediately after that, and I, of course, still have the letter, Dr. Hynek and I both received a letter from the director of the Orion Project, and he said, while we're finding significant differences between the ring soil and the control soil, due to a change in management, we're no longer able to look at this material. And wouldn't you know, that would happen when they're getting at the really good stuff. And, of course, we immediately thought, well, they do a lot of government work. So, that's unfortunate. But, and I'll be, again, I hate to keep saying this, but I want to alert people that those images from the electron microscope will be on the website when I get the Delphos report posted. And pretty interesting.
You know, oddly enough, some of the traces that you've been mentioning, such as plant material and soil material reacting as if they had been microwaved, that sounds a lot like some of the traces they've been finding in crop circles.
Since I, and I, you know, I don't want to put anybody off by this, but I don't yet see any direct relationship between UFOs and crop circles, in that in the 3,238 cases where an object was seen landing and generating traces, I never, ever encountered anything like a crop circle. And so at this point, I leave that to the crop circle experts, and I stay busy enough with this other stuff. But I do know there. One of the problems, I have to be upfront with this. One of the problems is that some of the crop circle people are now starting to call known landing sites crop circles, and I have never, in any of the landing cases I've investigated or I'm familiar with, have seen anything like the crop circles. And
well, the closest I know of is the Thule saucer nests of Australia in the 60s that Dr. James McDonald went and checked out.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I'm very familiar with that one. Bill Chalker investigated that and sent me the photos and all the information on it. And I'm not sure I would call that a crop circle. I mean, not is what I call a crop circle, or in my mind, what crop circle folks call crop circles are the large designed circular things. And the problem is, as I was saying, they're trying to come down from these gigantic things to anything that's no matter how small it is around depression
or burned, well, they don't use burned areas, but depression in plants and calling it a crop circle. And I think we have to be very careful because that is coming close to throwing Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster into ufology. And there's plenty going on in real UFO cases that I think we have to be careful not to really start muddying up the water. And one of the best cases I've ever investigated was in Langenberg, Saskatchewan. And recently I saw one of the crop circle folks calling the Langenberg rings crop circles. And I see no basis at all for calling them that.
Well, the only reason why I brought up the Tui saucer nests of Australia is they had the swirl pattern in the vegetation. But weren't these also like in a marshy area?
Yes.
Marshy, or a pond?
Right, yeah. And they actually found, I believe it was three landing imprints in the bottom of this marshy area underneath the effect. And so I don't think there's any question that this thing landed there. But it gets a little bit involved, but I'll try it quickly. The physical trace landing sites generated by a UFO are not ever as large as the classic crop circles. They generally don't exceed 30 feet in diameter, which was the Tully site. There have been several of those. And they come on down to sometimes a 3-foot circle. Generally, the majority of them will be between 8 and 11 feet in diameter, and they are swirled. They're compressed to the ground, generally with the centers still upright and unchanged. And the Langenberg objects didn't touch the ground. They hovered at the top of high grass, and they were rotating rapidly. And when they took off, the farmer, this was in daylight, could see two stem-like devices coming out like exhaust out of the base of these five objects. And as they ascended, there was a silent gust of gray vapor that came out of each of these pipe-like extensions. And so if you put those objects back on the ground where he first saw them, or just above the ground, and they're rotating, and they're exhausting whatever this stuff is, then you're going to have that swirl-down effect. So that tells you how these rings were generated and what the purpose of the five objects being in that high grass might be. There's no way to tell. But the owner
of the property said he saw objects in the sky, too.
Well, he saw them at first. He walked up on the first one to within 15 feet of it, and he could see it quite well. And it was about 11 feet in diameter, about 5 feet thick. And when he backed up to the thresher and got up on it, he saw the other four. And they were in kind of a semicircle around this slough in high grass. And after he watched them for just a brief time, they ascended vertically in a step formation, stopped at the base of the clouds, and formed a straight line. This was this gray vapor, and blew his cap off, and then they ascended vertically up into the clouds, and he went immediately and found the rings. And those range from 8 to 11 feet in diameter, and pretty impressive stuff. It was a very good case.
And I have to admit, I was pretty amazed when I first read the account of that, and again, as a kid.
Yeah.
We have one more person up who would like to ask a question. Are you up to that?
Okay, great.
Okay, yeah. Princess, you're up on the mic and live with Ted Phillips.
Hello, good evening. Mr. Phillips, Do you have any reports of any noctural lights created residue on concrete matter and a chalky substance that does not remove under any weather condition at all? Have you ever come across any kind of cases like that before?
Yes, yes. Now, the, and on concrete, you say?
She can't hear you, or she can't answer now. She's on her computer answering through the microphone on her computer.
Oh, okay, okay. Yes, I have had quite a number of cases involving the deposit of white material on soil, on concrete, a couple on the roof of a house, and it is very durable. It stays there for a great period of time. And I'm thinking of a case, well, since you mentioned concrete, what I wanted to ask was there any effect on the concrete? Because another great report from Brazil, security guard hears a loud noise, and it's raining pretty heavily, and he's at one of the major security dams in Brazil, and he walks outside the guardhouse, and he sees an object ringed with very bright lights that are changing colors in a sequence around the rim, and he walks within 35 feet of it, and thinking that it might be something that would sabotage or damage the dam, he takes out his .38 revolver and fires several shots. Other guards hear the bullets ricocheting off of a solid source, and a brilliant beam of light comes out of the object, hits the first guard, and he falls to the ground, and he's totally blind. And they cart him off to a hospital, and he is totally blind for 14 days. And I managed to get the hospital reports on that. He was interviewed by a lot of military people, and the interesting thing was that when the other guards returned, they went to the area where this object had been hovering, and in the pouring rain, the concrete in a 9-foot circle was completely dry, and the next morning it was starting to crack and break up. So
In answer to your question, if any marks were left on the concrete, she mm-hmm. said yes, there were.
Oh, really? I really wish that if she would go...
A white chalky substance.
If she would go on the website and go to the SIU team section, she'll see how she can contact us. It's got her email addresses on there, and I would greatly appreciate it if she would send me the information on that. I'd love to have it. And of course, no names, you know, don't worry about that, but I'd really love to
have that. Princess, there you go. Let's see, we've got about another 3 minutes to go.
Well,
would you like to mention any new documentary projects that are going on, or anything else that you'd like to mention?
Well, I would mention that we have been contacted by a very large TV production outfit overseas about doing a 2-hour documentary on the investigative team, and some of that I think will be done at Marley Woods. And so they might want to kind of watch. Well, they can go to the website, and we'll let everybody know how that's coming along. And we're also working on another TV documentary on one of the cable channels, and we'll announce anything like that on the website. And of course, any new sightings at Marley Woods or anywhere else that we get. I do have posted on there a recent sighting which took place, wouldn't you know, less than 2 miles from where I live. And I was talking to the witnesses while they were still watching it. And I got out there and it was already gone. But it's an excellent sighting of two of the basketball-sized light balls.
And this is a very detailed and extremely interesting case, and it took place September 1st of this year, and is on the website. And I think they'd enjoy that one.
Okay, can we sneak one more quick question in?
Sure.
This individual, she's a sweetheart, and she does a lot of research work for me.
Well, great.
Monette, you're live and on the air with Ted Phillips. I don't know if she's having problems or not. Okay, I guess we're having problems, and we've only got like a minute to go. I'm sorry, hon, I tried.
Would you ask her, if you can, ask her to email me that question. Go to the website and give me an email and ask a question. I'd be glad to answer it. I would like to.
That's great. Fantastic. So, Marnette, go ahead and email your question to Ted, and he'll get it answered for you. And unfortunately, darn it, we're out of time. I could go on for more. This has been a wonderful evening, and thank you again for being on. And we'll have to get you back on again.
Okay, fine, sure.
I've enjoyed that. It's been a really good evening, and lots of record breaking attendance in our virtual auditorium tonight. And I want to thank all of our listeners on other servers and all over the world. I appreciate it. I also want to send a special thanks to Leslie Gunter. She writes for the weekly column for Gray Matters for the Denial of America and a monthly column in Beyond the Dial for UFO Magazine. She also has several blogs, including The Debris Field. And I want to send a special thanks to everyone for tuning in tonight and joining us here in our Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Tonight, your guest will be Kathleen Martin. Be sure to check in next week for more interesting talks here on Eye to the Sky. On the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Until then, everyone, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, all.